is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Christopher Mason, geneticist, computational biologist, and he is often a principal investigator and co-investigator for NASA. But right now, he's a professor at Weill Cornell Medicine, and he's going to guide us to the next 500 years. That is the title of his new book, subtitled Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Mason, Christopher, congratulations and good evening to you. I want you immediately to take us to the 23rd century. The generation ships that you propose. What is a generation ship and what are the challenges for the human beings and their colleagues on board that ship as it heads for a new sun? Good evening to you.
Good evening and thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. The generation ship is really a culmination of both technological and design and aerospace engineering that will let us get to a point where we can have a whole spacecraft that sends, that is launched towards another star that we've identified that has a habitable planet that eventually the people will get there and begin to explore and have humans exist around the light of a second sun. And to do this, I describe in the book that what this is a generation ship, meaning multiple generations live and die on the same spacecraft, which raises some pretty large ethical questions, but I also address that in the book. I argue it's a moral duty that we have as a species to enable humans to survive beyond this sun, to serve really as guardians and shepherds of life. And so, but to do that, eventually we're going to have to go towards another sun.
You make very clear that an inspiration for this was when you were gifted a copy of Isaac Asimov's Foundation. Foundation series is a vast number of volumes. What in the Foundation still inspires you, Doctor?
Well, one of the most extraordinary things about Isaac Asimov is he was far ahead of his time, that he envisioned an ease with which humans would, in the future, would go between solar systems, go across the galaxy, something kind of like Star Wars in that universe, where it wasn't even considered a big deal to go hop around between stars or planets. And that itself was interesting. But the other thing that was really extraordinary is he had something called prehistory in the book, where he'd recognized that collecting and preserving information was one of the most important things you could do as a species, because without it, you could kind of devolve into more barbarism and lose the technology that let you survive in different planets and places. So his passion for humanity and the value of knowledge are two things I really took from that book and the series. And it really, or even just the hope, to think that humans will exist that way instills also and assumes a hope that humans can do that, that we won't destroy ourselves, which I also subscribe to.
There are challenges on that generation ship, which we will now address in the intervening three centuries. Distance, energy, the interstellar medium itself to be able to navigate. Yep. Biological risk, which is enormous. And the target, the goal that you're heading towards. But I want to concentrate on just one that is a challenge to travel from here to low Earth orbit, from here to the moon, and from here to Mars. That's radiation in space. You Yes. propose that there are projects right now, one called PREPARE, that is looking at how human beings can adapt to the radiation in space. What is PREPARE, Chris?
PREPARE is a very interesting program that is trying to prepare, as the name implies, prepare the genetics of human cells, or also learning from other cells, how to respond to radiation when the risk gets really high. So the PREPARE stands for the preemptive expression of radiation responsive elements, basically that you activate genes when you know you're going into a hazardous zone. So what's interesting is this is sponsored by DARPA, the Defense Department, and they're looking at, you know, essentially a way to keep soldiers safe if they go into a radiological hazard, like a nuclear reactor or a nuclear fallout zone, or maybe biological threats, you know, like a virus. And so this is something that we've started doing this in our own lab, where we engineer human cells with genes from tardigrades or other organisms to keep them essentially, to enable them to really survive radiation and even recover faster. So we know we can take lessons from other creatures and either activate genes, which is kind of called epigenetic editing, where you, instead of adding a gene or taking away a gene, you just turn it on. But we also have ways where we can add genes to human cells, even from other creatures, and take their evolutionary lessons of radiation and then bring it into human cells.
You went quickly. Tardigrade. What is that, Chris?
Let me. I'll break it down a little bit. So Really, if the biological risk is one of the biggest ones, it's one of the key hazards identified by NASA and other space agencies that for long-term space flight, we know there's going to be a lot of radiation that will really ravage cells. We've seen this in the studies we've done on astronauts. And we really have kind of, you know, you have three options generally to try and prevent the radiation. You can actually physically protect against radiation, like a big barrier, like a huge lead block, but that's obviously heavy, and try and get it in space. You can do pharmacological or other, you know, medical countermeasures to some degree on cells that you actually, you know, if you get damaged, there's radiation therapies for it. There are also ways you can try and, you know, repair some of the side effects of reactive oxygen. But the third way is, what if biological? What if we actually activate the genes that are already native to our DNA to enable them to respond faster or better, or really bring the biology from other creatures? And so the tardigrades are one of those creatures we look at that gives us that third method of defense. We say, well, let's take a gene from these creatures. Tardigrades are called water bears. They can survive in the vacuum of space. They're on almost every piece of soil you might look at, these tiny little water bears. They're microscopic. But when you look at them, they're eukaryotic, so they're multicellular complex organisms. They look like tiny bears, and they can walk. But they can even survive in the vacuum of space. They kind of get dried out and desiccated. You can bring them back into the space station, rehydrate them, or bring them back down to Earth, and they'll start walking around again. Now, not all of them, they don't all survive, but the fact that they can survive both the vacuum of space and huge amounts of radiation has given us a lot of clues in the past few years about what we could maybe learn from them. So we took one of the genes found in them that's called DSUP, or DNA damage suppressor protein, and put it into human cells, and we can see an 80% reduction in DNA damage, and that it's stable. It stays that way. So it's really an extraordinary, you know, piece of cell work in our lab that shows this is possible.
So here in the early 21st century, we already are taking steps towards radiation defenses in interstellar space. One more detail before we plunge into what you do, which is the editing of the genome. What is deontogenic ethics?
Yeah, I wanted to propose a new framework that would drive this thinking. It's, okay, you think, well, how do we have a moral argument for us to go out into space? It's not just a technical one, or the common one is that we should explore space just because, or why did you climb Mount Everest just because, which I think is okay, but it's not as, I think, internally consistent or frankly as inspiring as to think like, what if this is actually a duty for our species? So Immanuel Kant wrote a lot about basically the what is duty, and think about the categorical imperative was his ethical framework. Because basically it's when you were a kid, someone would say, well, if you stole a candy bar, what if everybody stole a candy bar? What would the world look like? And so he talked about deontology, or this idea of what is your duty, essentially, for that ethical framework. The other thing people think about ethics is, well, what if you but the greatest good for the greatest number? That is also described as Mill's utilitarian ethics. And so these are two frameworks that I describe a bit in the book, but they don't. Neither one of them explicitly address spaceflight or humans going to other planets. What I wanted to do is think, what's something that's even before those two frameworks? It's antecedent necessarily to them. Is what is our duty as a species to our own DNA or to all other creatures' DNA, or really to any life form, including someday potentially AI-based life form? So I called it a deontogenic ethical framework, or sort of a genetic duty. And I argue that because we are the only species that knows about extinction and the loss of life or the loss of entire species and ecosystems, only we can prevent it. And that gives us a duty and really responsibility to serve as these kind of guardians, if you will, guardians of the galaxy, quite frankly, quite directly. And it means that this is unique to us today, but might not always be. But I propose this as a necessary duty, not just out of survival, which of course would help us survive, is thinking about how do we preserve our ecosystems and resources, but also helps us preserve life in the universe, which as far as we know is extremely rare. So as far as we know, it's only here. And so I think this gives us a real unique duty and responsibility, which is the genetic duty, deontogenic ethical framework. And genic is the genetic, and deonto is sort of your duty and the ontological framework behind it.
If I understand correctly, it isn't the utilitarianism of the 18th century, Jeremy Bentham, the greatest good for the greatest number. It is to do what is necessary to preserve life in the galaxy as long as possible, as long as we can imagine it.
Yes, and from that flows all the other ethical frameworks. But I like to say that the existence precedes the essence. And unless we exist, we cannot have either ethical framework. And there are also some other benefits to that. We survive. We also learn about how to explore life and change it.
Let us plunge into what you do in your lab all the time, and what you geneticists know are the miracles that are commonplace now for DNA and for the cell and for cellular life. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Christopher Mason is the author, a geneticist, a computational biologist, a professor at the Weill Cornell Medicine. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Dr. Christopher Mason of the Weill Cornell Medicine School. He's a professor. He's also a geneticist and a computational biologist and an author. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. We've started with the generational shift in the 23rd century, way back here in the beginning of the 21st century. What Chris does with his colleagues routinely is they edit DNA. And Chris has given me permission to use the metaphor, edit like a document, like I pull up Word document and cut and paste. Chris, what is CRISPR? What does it do?
Yeah, I think many in your audience has probably heard of CRISPR or read about it. And CRISPR, it stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. And that's a big mouthful. But what it really is basically a bacterial immune system. It's kind of like a system that keeps track of what viruses have bacteria encountered and then remembers them. And part of the process is cutting DNA and embedding DNA and replacing it to remember viruses that a bacteria has seen. And this has been used by many people, including Jennifer Doudna and Charpentier, the people who just won the Nobel Prize last year, to discover it really a couple decades ago, but then also to think, how do we use this in human cells or perfect the system, including work by those like Feng Zheng? Basically, these immune systems where you can go in and snip and cut and copy and paste, much like you think of when you pull up a Word document or a Google Doc and you say, I want to just start to typing, as if it's really the canvas of life that you can start to type in. Most of the canvas of life in the world today is DNA is already written. But this gives us a way to begin to edit the actual sort of canvas of life, the document of the genetic code of organisms. And it's really exciting because it's one of now several systems that let us do this. The CRISPR, there's other ones called Omega systems. There are new ways where you can think of a whole book of life and say, well, I'd like to make some changes. In some cases, it's already being used to cure disease, like sickle cell disease or beta thalassemia. We're using CRISPR in people's bodies as a therapeutic, which I talk about in the book. There's trials like this at New York Presbyterian, at Cornell where I'm at. There's trials all over around the world engineering immune cells to do this. So this is an extraordinary time. We are literally curing diseases with these tools. And so, and high school students can use CRISPR and modify genomes and DNA, right at the bench. So it's really, it is an empowering time to edit DNA. And soon we can even start to build whole new bits of DNA systems.
Is this what Isaac Asimov referred to when he used the 20th century word mutation, except for you're in charge?
Yeah, exactly. Mutation historically is always random. You don't know, when you walk down the street, you get some too much sunlight, UV radiation, random cosmic rays. But instead of being subject to the shuffle of the deck of the universe, which is random and whimsical, we now can really take the steering wheel of mutations and direct them and even repair them and change them. So that alone is already extraordinary. But what's also amazing is there's now epigenome editing. So if you can imagine editing the document of life, like if you have a book in your hand, you say, I'd like to move these paragraphs or edit these words. The epigenome is how, the book of life is open to be read or not. And so this is when you have DNA. Imagine if you have a book, but you can only read 2 pages, but it has 100 pages, but you just can't see them all. That's how your genome, your DNA normally exists. With epigenome editing tools, as I talk about as well in the book and we do in my lab, you can change that as well. You can even change how and when the DNA gets used, not just what DNA is there. So the two different really explosion of tools in the past 10 years have dramatically changed how we view really the next few centuries.
There is a genetic toolbox. You're unpacking that genetic toolbox. You're taking charge of the results of that genetic toolbox. You mentioned a news item over these last years that is illustrative of where we are in the early 21st century. I believe the man's name was He Jianku, and in 2019, he edited a toolbox to preserve the possibility of giving birth to a couple that was plagued by a disease. But in any event, babies were born. and he was arrested and punished. Why?
There are multiple reasons why he was punished. It's a question of can we epigenetically, can we make human embryos that have been genetically modified? It's no longer hypothetical. It's been done, as you just described. And the problem with what he did was that it was he did a protocol to inform the parents, this is what we're going to do with your embryos, this is what we're actually doing. But the consent was actually not that they couldn't really understand it, is what one of the big criticisms, that he was kind of glossing over some of the complications of it. But even if they understood it, one of the biggest challenges what he did is what he did is something called a CCR5 deletion, which is you take this gene, which is kind of the receptor that lets HIV into your T cells, so it basically brings the virus into the cells. And his idea on the surface seemed okay. Like, well, let's just get rid of that receptor, so then the virus can't get into your human cells. And then you basically can be immune to HIV, which sounds kind of, you know, sounds good. I wish I could be immune to every virus, right? And just be natively immune at birth. And we know this because some patients who are born with this mutation are also immune to almost all forms of HIV. So on the surface, it seemed like a good idea. But the problem is that gene, which is called CCR5, also, if you have that deletion, you have a higher risk of getting West Nile virus and having complications. So in genetics, we call this pleiotropy. It means maybe you've protected yourself against one thing, but then you may have gotten a risk for a second problem. So so there was consent problems and then also just biological problems that we don't yet know enough to start editing embryos quite yet, I'd say.
The present condition, however, you project into the future. The whole joy of this book is that Chris is not looking just now, he's looking forward.
Right, right.
You believe that in the next 20 years, you will have a toolbox that gives you confidence where to cut and what result you're going to have?
Absolutely, because there are more than one ways to prepare the document of life, and there are better ways to do the editing where you have, as far as we can tell, you edit only one base out of 3 billion and nowhere else. And the tools are being developed as we speak, some in my lab, many in many other labs, but one is called prime editing or called PEG guide RNAs, these different RNAs that basically make it much more precise cuts than, as far as we can tell, are perfect in some cases. So you only get that one spot change. And there's also other kinds of systems beyond CRISPR, as I alluded to, that can do this kind of enzymology or this kind of cutting. So it's like going into a kitchen where we've only found a few, you know, knives and some maybe tongs, and we think, okay, we can start to cook a meal. But suddenly we found there's all these other tools that we're discovering that let us do all sorts of work in the kitchen. And so this is just getting started. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see a lot more of this. And there's already lots of clinical trials, but we'll see even more. And once we know it's safe and effective, then we can deploy it for people like astronauts or others as well, who aren't sick, but are just going into high risk areas.
Right. Astronauts are the focus here because we're talking about interstellar travel and what you need to arm yourself for the risks of that environment where we were not developed for the last several million years. We have an atmosphere and a magnetosphere protecting us, and Chris is talking about preparing us for beyond that.
Exactly.
The book
exactly.
is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Christopher Mason of the Weill Cornell Medicine Professor, and we're turning now to editing cells, cellular engineering. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Dr. Christopher Mason, geneticist, computational biologist, principal investigator and co-investigator with NASA, and professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. All of that to get to the word engineering. It's a wonderful word. We've talked about editing DNA, but now we're talking about a cell that's alive and what is to be done with that cell. Chris, if I understand, and I quickly got lost, we're already in this process of taking cells and putting them to work in some fashion. What is important is we're doing this for space. What is it that we need to do with our cells to make them appropriate? We've talked about adjusting them for radiation. What else can we adjust them for?
We can do a lot of other tweak some modifications to our cells. So the biggest risks are just to survive, right? So once you address that at a tissue level, in a developmental level, you've made it to out into space, and then you get to a planet that maybe has only methane or only other strange, atoms or even elements that you can use for your biology. What if we could take lessons from other creatures? So for example, I describe ways we can modify T cells to make the immune system even more precise, which we do in my lab now and have clinical trials on this. But what if instead of just, tweaking our immune cells or making new versions of them, you can engineer the whole cell and change what's on the outside, change what's on the inside. What if we could also take, for example, like plants? So there's, these large, we all look at plants every day. They're everywhere. They have chloroplasts, which absorb sunlight and convert it into glucose and food for their cells. What if we could do that for human cells? So I describe the formulas and the math behind how much skin you would need to have if you became a chlorohuman, which is about 2 tennis courts worth of skin if you just wanted to lay outside for 1 hour if you're hungry to get enough energy for your body. So I talk a little bit about those options, but then also learning from extremophiles who survive in high and low temperature or salinity or other stress on their cells, and then they can survive even, in the harshest of environments like the bottom of the ocean. So we could bring those in as well.
We right now have hybrid cells that are put to work. Is this immunotherapy? Is that what we're talking about?
Exactly right. So one of the things that, again, I think people think like, oh, this idea of hybrid cells or engineered cells that we're putting into people seems like science fiction, that it is widely deployed. There are actually, at this point, over 1,000 clinical trials worldwide, which we actually just published a paper on, that are doing these engineered cells almost all for cancer therapy, where you take the cells and you say, I want to convert this T cell or sometimes a natural killer cell, and I want to change what it can recognize and have it then go after a cancer cell. And actually what you can do is reprogram. These are called CAR T therapies, or chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapies, which the chimera means like the Greek tale of actually merging two animal species together. It's a true chimera where you actually have, different proteins that are not normally on that cell, and modify them. You can grow them up and then infuse them back into the cancer patient to treat lymphomas or leukemias. And now it's being treated for actually over 24 different kinds of cancer, including solid cancer. So this is everywhere. It's all over the world. So you get this idea that it's something in the future or it doesn't happen that often or that commonly. It is globally distributed and extraordinarily successful. And so you can change what's on the inside of the cell or the outside of the cell, especially immune cells.
You begin your storytelling with the twins, the Kelly twins, Scott and Mark, one who spent 340 days, I believe, almost a full year in orbit, and his brother. And when Scott returned to Earth, you did repeated physicals on him, and there was a lot of damage on his body, a lot of damage that looked scary to me. And he's a brave man, and he wrote it out. At one point he asked you, can't you just CRISPR this mutation away? Wonderful conversation. I'll remember to ask you that, Chris, sometime. Can you CRISPR this away? However, what did we learn about adjusting the human body, not just for generational shift in the 23rd century, but for life on Mars, because that's imaginable now, a Mars colony? What can we do?
Yeah, a Mars colony shouldn't be too far away, maybe 10 years away. We should 10 to 12 years, and Chinese might get there before the U.S. does at this current rate, it looks like. So it's not that far away. And what we can do, and as you described the story in the book, I related a story during, we present the results to, it's like any clinical trial. You present the results to your patients, and you tell them how the research is going. And I described these mutations, and he said, well, okay, I've heard about CRISPR. Can't you just get rid of the mutations? And what's interesting is this was about 3 years ago when we first presented some results. And then I said, well, it's not ready yet. But I said, but someday, actually, yes. And I said, actually, I'm just starting to write a book about that because I was just getting going. And I said, I think in the future, this will be very possible. You could say we've sequenced what's coming out of even your urine or your blood and say, we've seen a new mutation. Let's actually design something that would go and fix the mutation. The biggest challenge with that is just getting it to the one cell that has that mutation. That is the issue. But you can also target, say, just at your bone marrow, where you make most of your blood, for example. So, these are a bit futuristic, but as evidenced by clinical trials today, where we're modifying current cells or even doing CRISPR in bodies for diseases and curing them, it is possible to do.
Preparing a human being, our biome, for life on Mars, with the, what is it, about 38% gravity of Earth, radiation on the surface. The soil is unknown at this point. We don't know whether it has toxicity. We can speculate at this point. but also we're looking at reduced sunlight and the long-term effects of living on a planet, knowing that returning to Earth is going to be a challenge to your body. Perhaps you can't survive it. So are you looking at creating human beings that can only live on Mars and not return?
Ideally, no. We'd hopefully have it so they can have, we've built humans or modified systems that we give to humans and astronauts so that they could have as much planetary liberty as possible. I describe it in the book as cellular liberty. Like what your cells ideally should be able to do anything you need them to do. They have the greatest capacity to actually give you functions. And the same thing is true of the bodies. If we've made people so they can, you know, are exquisitely modified, but they can never come back to Earth or even visit, I feel like we will have failed. I feel like there is a challenge before us that I think is surmountable. We can engineer cells to be plastic and adaptive, much like we do for cancer therapies, to change what they are doing and how they function, genetic and epigenetic modification methods, give you the greatest plasticity so your cells can survive on the most possible. And I describe that as a planetary liberty that we have to get as broad as possible.
There are inspirations here on Earth for you. They're called extremophiles. The list is long. Thermophiles for hot, psychrophiles for cold, radiophiles for radiation. The one I like best was polyextremophiles. In other words, an extremophile for all seasons. Is that a guide to what we can do with human cells as well?
It absolutely is. I mean, what's amazing is this discussion of, you know, could life survive on Mars or will we find microbial life elsewhere in the universe? I think we at some point probably will, because everywhere we look on Earth, we found that microbes have pretty much adapted and found some way to survive, whether it's, you know, surviving really at the border of a hydrothermal vent at the bottom of the ocean, you know, crushing pressure, extreme temperature changes in salinity, but still surviving. And we've also seen that they can survive, you know, even at the rims of volcanoes or even sometimes in the atmosphere. Some species of bacillus, as bacteria, can survive in space, be radiated and completely dried out and then bring back and grow them up. So we have a precedent. We know that life can be adapted to these environments. And I talk about going to Titan is that eventually you'd have to adapt to be able to use all the methane that's there and the cold temperatures. But we know something probably could survive there if we engineered it and took all the lessons of creatures on Earth and brought it to bear, at least for microbes and someday potentially humans.
Doctor, forgive me, but in reading your book, I made notes to myself about puzzles I have. Is it adequate under your understanding of deontogenic ethics that you're successful at creating life that can exist on Titan and Mars and beyond that is not human? Is that a success?
I like to say that I am towards cognition, I am matter agnostic. That means whatever the state of matter is that is creating cognitive and states and sentience, I'm okay with, as long as they subscribe, I think, to the deontogenic ethic frameworks, or that they are good, that they're nice creatures, whatever they're made out of.
I go to an example you give us, the silver foxes that a Russian team once taking generation after generation of a fox life, however that long is, and managed to find a way to make that fox a pet. That is a success. That would be a success on another planet within the memory of just a few decades, correct?
Yep. Yeah, it was extraordinary. It only started in the 30s. Within only a matter of about 40 to 50 years, they took all the foxes, the ones that were the most docile and calm, and only bred those. And the more angry and aggressive foxes in this Russian lab, they just kind of let die eventually. But managed to give it, so they became foxes, basically became dogs. Their ears began to get floppy. They began to trace human eye movement. And so they'd watch you. Their tails began to wag. They created dogs in a matter of really just 50 years. So if you guide evolution rather than let it drift, you can create complex new types of animals pretty fast. And so this is definitely something that we know is possible.
This is a joy, Chris. Dr. Christopher Mason, geneticist and computational biologist at the Weill Cornell Medicine School. He's a professor. The book is The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. And when we come back, in my imagination, I'm going to ask Chris to take me on that generational ship, and we'll head out for another sun, hibernation, and dealing with the long wait, and robots, AI robots that take care of us, including making our own amino acids. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor with Dr. Christopher Mason, a geneticist, computational biologist. He's a professor at the Weill Cornell Medicine School. However, the author of The Next 500 Years. In the 23rd century, we have engineered life. There's Homo sapiens and his or her allies, friends, companions, including AI. We're on a generational ship and we're headed to another sun. There are challenges. We're not going to engineer this. I'm going to talk about some aspects of Chris's presentation that are exciting. Chris, on board this generational ship are exo-wombs. Why and what does that do for creating the possibility of life throughout the galaxy?
This technology that underlies exo-wombs, or really kind of artificial uteruses, hasn't really exploded in the past couple decades, where now you can grow almost to term, at least some goats that have been done, as well as some mice, from embryogenesis almost all the way to adulthood, or to birth, I should say, the entire process of development, embryogenesis, becoming a fetus, and then making your way into the world to live on your own. And this kind of exo-womb technology could, in theory, give you the greatest possible cellular liberty we talked about before, that all your cells should, you should be able to have physical liberty with your body and your cellular liberty with your cells. And this lets you say, well, if I would like to have a system that can grow the human embryos, you could even have a robot watching over them while they grow and they get to the new planet. And then you get human caretakers, because it's hard to get humans to go and survive all the way to the other planet. You either have to put them asleep or have a generation ship, or multiple people live in multiple generations live and die. Or you have all the embryos frozen and have a robot do this. And there was recently a show called Raised by Wolves that put this into video format. So this idea has been in science fiction for a while, but we actually now have the technology that can enable it almost completely.
I like the idea of using that chloro-human, because that either bypasses or solves the food source. You need sunlight, yep, and the chlorophyll that is part of chloro-humans, although I don't fancy looking like an amoeba spread all over Boston Harbor, but I understand we've got a mission here. We've got a mission. Along with exo-wombs, and there's some other language here. What is diapause? I think you just described it.
Yes, a bit of a way to have diapause is similar to hibernation, where if you have an embryo that you eventually want your embryo to come to, full term and become its own organism. But diapause is a way where you can actually have an embryo be fertilized, but just wait. And this is surprising, because you think, well, that sounds like a weird thing to do to an embryo. But from an evolutionary perspective, it's actually brilliant, because if for some reason you know that the resources are limited at that time, you can pause embryogenesis. You can basically say, well, hang on, we'll just develop a little bit later. And so some of the genes that we know that drive this process, as well as hibernation, we now know. So we can actually have a similar process in humans, or in these exo-wombs that are on their way towards another planet, as you begin the embryo, but then have it just wait a little while till you get to the right spot.
We are on this generational ship, and we have a number of challenges. One is, as we just discussed, it's going to be a long time. Presuming you have the energy to get there, and presuming you've got the navigation tools to get there, it's going to be a long time. What can we learn from bears? I have black bears all around me here in Western Connecticut. What can I learn from them, Chris?
Bears are extraordinary, and I think that is one of the most extraordinary and wonderful parts of being a geneticist today, is that we're continually sequencing and understanding and learning about life and how it's adapted. And bears are a great example. When they hibernate, their blood becomes as thick as basically barbecue sauce. As most people know, they eat a bunch and then they basically sleep and barely move. But their blood sugars spike all over the place, insulin spikes, but they don't get diabetes. And they really have this amazing, there's thousands of genes that become active to enable this state. And so we didn't know what they were 10 years ago, but I talk about some work by Joanna Kelly, who's a friend who studies this. And we now know some of the very specific molecular mechanisms that are creating us this hibernation state. So if we could, in theory, learn, deploy some of those genes in humans, it's possible we could take some of those traits of hibernation, although it hasn't been tried yet. But NASA actually just funded several grants to look at this exact question, because now that we know what's driving it in bears, maybe we could try and start in human cells, and maybe even try it in humans.
So we could both make embryos dormant for X number of years and make the humans, or the human, I don't know what to say, human bear? Also available for a number of years. We can put, and not just depend on robots. You want backup systems.
Exactly. Because it could be a radiation surge. There could be a problem with one of the ships. So it's good to have, like, NASA normally has a backup plan for every backup plan. So that's one thing that's been fun working with them, is there's almost always redundancy built into every system. And so we'd want to do the same thing with our biology as we do with our engineering.
We're in the 24th century now, and the generation ships are launched, and we introduce, and this is pure Asimov. It's very clever of you. What is a guardian?
A guardian is us. I think at that time, this is a fulfillment of the deontogenic ethics, is that there is, whether it's AI or whether it's carbon-based or humans, the guardians are people who recognize it. We recognize it in ourselves. Life is rare. Life is unique. You know, life's not perfect. There are some really mean people and angry people, and, you know, people can steal and murder and maim. But also, life is precious in the universe. It is, as far as we know, so far only on this planet. And it is up to us to serve as the guardians of it, you know, not just in a selfish and solipsistic way, but because we were dependent on these organisms to survive ourselves. And we can serve as actually the guardians. It is a duty I propose for our species. And most people pick one or two duties for their own lives, but we have yet to really nucleate around a duty for our species. And I propose that we should be a new kind of species, which is the guardians, the ones that recognize the frailty of life itself, but can actually act to preserve it and even expand it to where it survives.
If I understand the logic, Chris, you have to take a Cornell lab with you when you go exploring, because you're not going to know. You call something ISRU, In-Situ Resource Utilization. You've got to carry pharmacy with you. You have to carry the elements with you, because we don't generate enough vitamins of ourselves. You have to take all that with you. Plus, a Christopher Mason chloro human. We have to take all this. Correct. All that has to go.
That's right. And, you know, so there's, I call this almost like as a cellular, you know, ineptitude, is that, you know, there's several amino acids that we need, you know, in our bodies, but that we don't make. And so but other organisms do. So I have a whole section in the book that describes, we can just take those genes from those other organisms and make it so we can make all of our own amino acids, make our own vitamin C. We used to do other primates do this, but we no longer do. And so we could reactivate that gene. And so I describe ways to just make us a little bit more self-reliant. And also then we'd bring the lab. We'd have to bring our pharmacy, create our medicines wherever the new planet is. But the fun part I actually love is that I describe a lot of the planets that have been found in the past 10 years that we, you know, this was pure science fiction 20, 25 years ago. We had no planets that we could even look at to maybe survive on. Now there's it was extraordinarily, you know, euphoric to make the list of, here's all these planets that we could get to and possibly survive. We just have to get there. But we didn't have the technology to get there 20 years ago, and we didn't even know the planets to where we could survive. But now we have both.
And Chris, a final 30 seconds. How long would it take to create a human being, starting here in the 21st century, to create many human beings who can adapt to low gravity, to radiation, to the fact that they're going to have to generate their own vitamins? Is that centuries in creation, or can we do that in several generations? What's your understanding of DNA?
It could be done, as shown with the silver fox, it could be in a matter of 50 years, you know, 40 or 50 years to get the very first organisms, the first humans that have been created with all those traits. But I propose to do an intergenerational clinical trial, basically. Like, we would want to watch these humans for two or three generations to make sure there's nothing that we've missed. I think we would really need, the reason the 500-year plan is so long is because I'd want us to have a couple centuries where we've really demonstrated safety and efficacy, like you do for any therapy, before we really say, okay, now we're good. Off you go to another planet. If we're in a rush, like if something goes wrong with the planet before then, maybe we wouldn't wait that long if we're worried about extinction. But if we have the time, I would propose it probably within about 200 years, it should be possible.
Christopher Mason, Dr. Christopher Mason of the Weill Cornell Medicine School. He's a professor, geneticist, and computational biologist. Most importantly, the author of The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. This is Foundation with Details. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.